Our poorly performing schools are not improving. A New Zealand initiative has released a report into our education system that paints a damning picture of government interventions failing to turn things around. Dr. Eric Crampton is the head of research at the New Zealand Initiative, and Dr. Crampton is with me. Eric, good evening to you, sir.
Good afternoon.
Can you give us some context around the schools performing poorly and what, nothing much has been done to turn them around? Is that what you conclude?
Well, there's a lot of schools that wind up failing for years and years and years. Now, many schools do get turned around, and NERO does have some very successful interventions. Lots of schools that were in fairly poorly performing categories do move up. But there's a rump tail that interventions haven't been working with that continue to fail year after year. So 20 out of the 185 schools that were not currently meeting expectations, they'd been poorly performing for at least three consecutive reviews. So that's 8 to 9 years on average. And some of them had been like that for a decade. So when something's failing for a decade, we start thinking that maybe we need to reassess how we're looking at the interventions and figuring out which interventions work.
Are you able to figure out with this systemic failure why the underperformance for, say, 10 years, a decade has been allowed to continue? Have you been able to figure that one out?
That's hard to say. A lot of the analyses are pretty bespoke. ERO would say that it's necessarily bespoke and school specific, but we think that we can make better use of some of the data that's out there. If we're not tracking which kinds of interventions work with which kinds of schools systematically, and if they're working with close to 200 schools every year to try and bring them towards better performance, you're getting more and more data about what works with which kind of schools and what doesn't tend to work. Some better analysis on that could really help some of these schools.
Can you expand on that? Because I read your piece last week in the NBR.
Yep.
Why are some state schools performing so badly? Is it the data not being shared? The Ministry of Education has this data, don't they?
Okay. So this is getting into a different aspect of underperformance. So what we've been talking about so far is underperformance and success as measured in the Educational Review Office's reviews of schools. So that'll be a mix of things like academic performance and financial management, keeping your HR policies up to date, those kinds of things. The other aspect of performance that's a lot more poorly understood is how different schools succeed and fail in teaching different kinds of students. So we have data opportunities available now that simply didn't exist a decade ago, and we think we can be making a lot better use of data. So to be very specific then, there's constant fights between central government and, say, the teachers' unions about performance management issues, where the unions would very rightly point out that a teacher who's faced with a classroom that never saw a book before they showed up at school is going to have a heck of a time getting close to national standards, no matter how well they're doing, and that you need to have some better recognition of the different circumstances that different teachers face. On the other side, the government's just been frustrated that they haven't been able to get any kind of performance management in. With the data we've got now, you can really tell whether a particular teacher is able to succeed or fail with the kinds of students that they have in their classroom. And we're just not doing it yet.
Right, but we have differences between, I mean, it's a lot of apples and oranges, but there's also apples and apples here, isn't there? Why a decile one school would be doing clearly very well and another decile one school not so well?
Well, that's exactly it. So you have some decile one schools that are getting very good results on national standards and other ones performing very poorly. And some of the very poorly performing ones could say, well, it's not really our fault. We're facing a different, difficult category of kids. They're just hard to teach. It's not up to us. If you're using better metrics that make very clear how schools are doing, given the kinds of clients they're facing, the kinds of students that they're trying to reach, then those kinds of excuses go away for ones that are trying to mask poor performance, either at the top by not quite performing as well as they could have with students who are going to do well anyways, or at the bottom. And we avoid beating with a big, stupid stick schools that are doing fantastically well with hard-to-teach students, but that aren't quite meeting the thresholds that we'd be wanting.
All right, but you have zeroed in on 8% of schools. That's 35,000 students, isn't it? Now, you believe a value-added model, as used in the United States, it would be a way of moving forward. Can you explain what
sure.
that is?
So it's used in some parts of the states. It's just starting to come in. So instead of using something like an 85% NCEA pass rate benchmark or a percentage of students that are meeting national standards at primary as a benchmark, what you do instead is you look to see how students performed across different classrooms, conditional on things like, well, their parents' education, their parents' income, whether how many SIFS interventions those students' families have been involved in. All of those kinds of things are known by the government, and it's all linked up in the administrative data in the back end. And the government's already starting to use it for some purposes. They're starting to try and figure out which students are at risk of not completing NCEA Level 2. We can take that one better using a bit more sophisticated modeling, but it's all totally doable with what they've got now, to figure out how much extra is being taught, to how much kids are learning in each classroom compared to what they should be expected to learn when you look across the sector.
NZEI, the teachers' union, of course, have come out today and said there's an issue with that method. There's no evidence that those school systems had improved.
Oh, well, that's certainly not true. If you look at some work that's been going on in Washington, D.C., where they have combined that kind of a value-added measure with other broader, more holistic measures of teacher performance, had that all part of the principal's review of the teachers, and ultimately got rid of some of the more poorly performing teachers. They had spectacular increases in their students' performance, but we'll be going through some of that in Martine Udekahuma's second report that'll be coming out in a few months' time. She's just finished her travel over there to see how it all works.
Do you think the unions are causing a lot of this problem? Because they don't want to go anywhere near anything that's innovative, it seems.
Well, I can't blame them for not wanting to be beaten with a performance measure that is not fit for every classroom's purpose. So if I were a teacher and I had a classroom of students who, no matter how well I did, I'd only be able to get them so far, and it'd be a fantastic triumph if I got them that far, I wouldn't want to be damned for having done that. On the other side, there are going to be decile 10 schools that could end up coasting, getting like an 88% pass rate when the kids were going to pass anyways, likely from the parents helping at home. Once you start moving into finer grade performance measures where it actually knows what's going on in each classroom, or at least all the characteristics of the kids in the classroom and what the teacher's really there facing, then it gets a lot harder to rationalize objections to those kinds of measurements.
Thank you for coming on the program. Good to talk to you again. That is Dr. Eric Crampton, Head of Research at the New Zealand Initiative. It's 4:17.
Stay healthy. This flu